Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The Nimrod International Journal of Prose and Poetry hosts its annual Conference for Readers and Writers this Saturday at the Alan Chapman at Student Union on the University of Tulsa campus. The conference will feature over 30 writers and editors, including the judges and winners of Nimrod's annual literary awards. You can learn more about the conference at nimrod.utulsa.edu. My guest today will be one of the guests of the conference, an accomplished poet, memoirist, and editor. Jill Bylofsky is a executive editor at W.W. Norton and the author of the New York Times bestselling memoir, History of a Suicide, My Sister's Unfinished Life. It's a story of her relationship with her stepsister, Kim, who committed suicide in 1990. She's also an accomplished novelist and poet with several novels and four collections of poetry, including her latest, The Players. Her latest book is a combination of memoir of her own life as well as an anthology of poetry that's important to her. It's titled Poetry Will Save Your Life. It's published by Atria Books. She'll be participating in sessions on memoir writing and editing and publishing at the conference. Jill Bylofsky joins me today on Studio Tulsa. Jill Bylofsky, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Would you start by reading a poem of your own?
Yes. I'd like to read Daylight Savings, and this is a poem from my latest volume of poetry called The Players that's published by Alfred A. Knopf. Daylight Savings. There was the hour when, raging with fever, they thrashed, the hour when they called out in fright, the hour when they fell asleep against our bodies, the hour when without us they might die, the hour before school and the hour after. The hour when we buttered their toast and made them meals from the four important food groups. What else could we do to ensure they'd get strong and grow? There was the hour where we were the spectators at a recital, baseball game, when they debuted in the school play. There was the silent hour in the car when they were angry, the hour when they broke curfew, the hour when we waited for the turn of the lock, knowing they were safe and we could finally close our eyes and sleep. The hour when they were hurt or betrayed and there was nothing we could do to ease the pain. There was the hour when we stood by their bedsides with ginger ale or juice until the fever broke. The hour when we lost our temper and the hour we were filled with regret. The hour when we slapped their cheeks and held our hand in wonder. The hour when we wished for more. The hour when their tall and strong bodies, their newly formed curves and angles in their faces, and Adam's apple surprised us. Who had they become? Hours when we waited and waited, when we rushed home from the office or sat in their teacher's classroom, awaiting the report of where they stumbled and where they excelled. The hours when they were without us, the precious hour we did not want to lose each year, even if it meant another hour of daylight.
Very nice poem. I have to figure, a lot of these poems were written about the time your son was heading off to college?
Yes, yes, that's true. I think that without really knowing it, I was already turning his childhood into elegy. But yes, I really, in The Players, I recognize now that I was very much reflecting on parenthood and motherhood and that strange recognition when you see your child becoming a person of his own, which is quite remarkable.
Was this written in preparation as he was getting ready to leave the house, or was it after he left the house?
What happened was that there's a central poem in the book called Manhood, and it's about baseball. Hmm. And my son, it's in 13 parts, and one part, for instance, is called The Mothers.
Yes.
Another section is called The Fathers. Then there's The Girls. And what I attempted to do was to create, in a sense, the American family through the prism of baseball, since I had spent so much time watching the players and the parents and the girlfriends, and that sort of became the cornerstone of the book, The Players. The book came out, I think, right when my son was in his first year of college.
I happen to read The Mothers, and I love this poem. It starts, "We loved them. We got up early to toast their bagels, wrap them in foil." And later it talks about the trials of a mother raising a son. When they don't want to talk, they just grunt and refusal to form a full sentence. But I love the last few lines of that. "Throughout summer, we watched the trees behind the field grow fuller and more vibrant, and each fall slowly lose their foliage. It was as if we wanted to hold on to every and each leaf." That was really beautiful. And that's really that's the way a lot of parents feel about, you know, their kids, I think.
Yes, I hope so. That's such a special gift.
Let's talk a little bit about your latest book, Poetry Will Save Your Life, a memoir, which is sort of an amalgam of some of your most beloved poetry that you've read and personal memoir. How did this book come about? Did it start out to be a poetry collection, or did you have the idea of blending your own personal story with this poetry from the start?
That's a good question, Rich, and you are correct. The idea for this book came about because I was having lunch with my editor, and he asked me about my connection to poetry. He was the editor for a previous memoir that I wrote called History of a Suicide. And we were talking about poetry, and I told him about some of the poems that were very influential to me as a young person. And he asked me if I would consider putting together an anthology of poems. What ended up happening was that I put together this collection of poems, and I wrote some headnotes, but I recognized that I wasn't fully happy with it because there are so many anthologies in the marketplace, and I thought, why would anybody want to pick up my book? What is special that I'm offering? And so I went and thought about it further, and I decided to just actually write about the personal experiences that I thought about, particular poems that were touchstones in my coming of age and in my girlhood and adolescence and also my adulthood, and that were very formative for me. Either there were poems that I found that inspired a memory of my own experience, or a poem that helped me to think about a difficult time in my life. And once I started doing that, the book really came to life for me, and it was actually a joy to write because I recognized how deeply my inner life has been entwined with poetry, even before I knew that some of the poems that I discovered when I was younger were actually poems. So it was very rewarding for me personally to realize how poetry and language can connect us to a wider universe and offer companionship and a sense of understanding of experience by seeing something through another poet's eyes or gaze or experience.
As I was reading through the collection, it seemed that some poems were very close to the experiences that you're relating. You know, they were directly intertwined at the time. Others seem like they were brought back the memory of those circumstances. Was that the case, that some were directly intertwined with the events you describe? For example, the very first poem in the book is Robert Frost's The Road Not Taken. And this was the first poem, I think, that you heard in school that sort of really spoke to you. But other poems seem to be poems maybe you discovered later that sort of triggered memories.
Yes, that's exactly how it was. I could have chosen 100 poems or even 1,000 poems, to be honest, but I had a particular guidelines for myself. First of all, I didn't want to choose poems from poets that were in my own age group. I wanted them to be the poets that sort of influenced my life in my coming of age. So, I also wanted to choose poems that I felt would be accessible to the everyday reader, and not necessarily poets themselves or academics, because I'm not an academic. In my day job, I'm an editor at Norton at a book publishing company, and the way in which I approached this book was non-academic, if you will.
Now, you've probably written, quote, academic poems in your career, but for the most part, most of the poetry I've seen by you has been very vernacular of the day, of an experience, of a memory, and just in everyday language.
Yes, that's exactly right. And I wanted to choose poems in this book that also I felt would be accessible to the reader.
Now, one of the things that you do throughout the book is sort of put together through various feelings, discovery, wonder, selfhood, shame, ancestors, death, fathers, faith. And then you're telling various stories from your life. It seems to me this was a well-crafted, you know, collection of poems and stories, but it must have taken a lot of honing to get it to this point, I would think.
Yes, it did, because as I mentioned earlier, I at first thought of this more as an anthology, and so I thought about these chapter headings. But as the book progressed, I also recognized that I wanted it to be a book, too, that young people might read, and because I think that we're living in a very tenuous world for young people, and that poetry can be extremely grounding and inspirational. And so I thought that by using these chapter headings that you describe, that a reader could not necessarily have to read the book in chronological order, but could just read, for instance, a section called Shame, which is where I talk about two poems by Langston Hughes, or they could go directly to Passion, where I write about my first experiences as a young poet in New York City, and I talk about poems by Gerald Stern and St. Vincent Millay, Dennis Johnson, and Claude McKay. So I did want it to be, as I said, sort of a guide in some ways, because I think that young people deserve to really think about their lives in a mature way and not have to skirt difficult subject matter. So, for instance, I do have a section on depression and a section on suicide. And the suicide section, I have included one poem called Tulips by Sylvia Plath and a poem called Waking in the Blue by Robert Lowell. And I have a section called Grief, where I have chosen two poems, one called One Art by Elizabeth Bishop, and the other, Musée des Beaux-Arts by Auden. So in other words, I wanted readers to come upon poetry the way I did as a young person. In other words, that once I found particular poems, I was able to think about my own coming of age in a different way, and I felt less lonely than had I not come across those poems.
My guest today is Jill Bielowski, a poet, novelist, essayist, and editor, and she'll be a guest for Nimrod's Conference for Readers and Writers this Saturday at the University of Tulsa. And she's the author of her most recent book, is Poetry Will Save Your Life, a memoir. It's published by Atria Books. And she's also the author of the best-selling memoir, History of a Suicide, My Sister's Unfinished Life. She's written four collections of poetry and three novels as well. What I found interesting about, you know, you begin the book with stories from your youth, and they're very short personal stories, and then there's the poem, and you talk a little bit about the poem in each of these little chapters. As the book goes on, the stories get longer. They get more involved. They become more, you know, there's more ambiguity about the stories, and the poems get longer as well. I don't know if that was intended or unintended, but it was almost like you're drawing us in at the beginning with these, you know, very short poems, very short stories about, you know, your childhood. And then, of course, as you grow up and the stories are more subject to interpretation, even within your own life, as well as the poems, the narrative becomes more complex.
Yes, that's a very interesting takeaway. I actually did not think of that, but I'm sort of happy that that came through. I do think that I chose initially poems that, for instance, the first one I do write about is The Road Not Taken by Robert Frost, because that was the first poem that I understood to be a poem when my fifth grade teacher, Miss Hudson, read it aloud to the class, and I was able to connect to it in a very personal way. And I do think that as the book progresses, it does get more complex as my life became in some ways more complex.
Now, I was reading something you in an interview a few years ago, and you said you had received an important piece of advice from a teacher, said, write about what hurts. And you said, you know, as I've grown older, I feel like, no, I need to write about what I can't forget, which is in some way, sometimes it can be the same thing. Do you think that sums up how you consider your writing life today?
Yes, I do. I know that when I speak in front of groups or do workshops, I do exercises. I give exercises to the students to try and access what hurts or a particular kind of experience that perhaps they would never want to talk about in a group, because I do think that poetry does come from a dark place, and often the best poems are those that spring out of something that we're not even aware is there. So that's been my orientation to poetry. I'm sure other poets have different ways of gaining access to their material, but I definitely choose to write about experiences that haunt me or that I want to understand or just capture. For instance, in the poem I read, Daylight Savings, I wrote the poem because I was inspired by daylight savings time, you know, when we lose 1 hour, and I thought about how precious an hour can be. And then that poem sort of came to life for me.
Well, you write a great deal about your mother, and as you write in the book, and you've said many times, you know, you were your father died when you were 2 or 3. She remarried later in a marriage that was unsuccessful. Your mother has been an incredible part of your life. At the same time, you're saying goodbye to your son in the poems that form the players. Your mother is entering a different chapter of her life. And you wrote quite a bit about that in both prose and in poetry. You wrote a beautiful essay called How to Say Goodbye, and it was about, you know, those last days before your mother was moving to assisted living, and you were saying goodbye to the house. And then you wrote a lovely poem called The Guardians, which really summed a lot of that, those same feelings about, you know, saying goodbye to the home you grew up in. And I was really struck by something you wrote in the prose article, which was, you know, my mother seemed pretty much set on leaving this house that she lived on in her whole life, or in nearly her whole life. And you, on the other hand, were having a more difficult time saying goodbye to that house.
Yes, you're right, Rich. It was very complicated. And I'm so glad that you found that essay and you found the poem, The Guardians, because that particular poem means a lot to me. You know, I grew up in a family of all women, so to speak. My father did die when I was 2, and my mother had 2 other daughters. We were a year apart. We were Irish triplets, I guess it would be called. And then when my father died, and then when my mother remarried again when I was in 5th or 6th grade, she had another daughter. And so I was raised in this family, very feminine household. And my mother was, you know, sort of the central figure in my coming of age. And it's been very, you know, as the years progress, I do feel more of a sense of how influential she was to me and still is to me. I think there'll be more to come on that subject. There's more I want to write about.
Now, in the latest collection, Mortality is talks a little bit about this same story that you wrote in prose and in the poem, and you tell stories of your mother, and you use two really interesting poems, The Child is Father to the Man by Gerard Manley Hopkins, which was in turn inspired by My Heart Leaps Up by Wordsworth. And of course, the Hopkins poem ends with, the words are wild. The child is father to the man. The words are wild. And it's that idea that, and I assume this is where you are in your life now, where the child is mother to the woman.
Yes. And in some ways, that's just so true. And, you know, when you're younger, you never think that that is going to happen. I think when we're young, we're more self-obsessed. And as we get older, we can see our parents for who they were as individuals too, and then of course illness comes forward, and I feel lucky that I'm able to do as much as I can for my mother, because she certainly had a huge burden of taking care of her daughters basically on her own. In writing Poetry Will Save Your Life, I was able to really think about that more and reflect on that. And, you know, my mother didn't have a career because she came of age in the 50s where women really were meant to stay at home. And I always was fearful of that. And so I think that she gave me not only, you know, love, but also this feeling of wanting to make my own way in the world and not be dependent upon anyone else. And I want to share that with younger people, younger women as well. And so I hope that comes through in one of the sections, I think, where I write about, I think, Audrey and Rich's poem, Diving into the Wreck.
Yeah. That relationship really comes through in the collection, Poetry Will Save Your Life. And I imagine you probably will be writing more about your mother. You're going to be talking about writing memoirs, and you have written about very close to your heart subjects, about your family growing up, about your mother raising four girls by herself. You've written, you know, a remarkably poignant story of Kim, your youngest sister, in the history of a suicide. Can you take us into how you get started in writing such really personal and can be often hurtful memories coming back to the fore in writing about those in a memoir?
Mm-hmm. You know, I thought about this a lot because I think that sometimes there's a misunderstanding in terms of what a memoir actually is or what personal memoir, where it springs from. And the writer is able to choose particular events in a life that he or she feels can convey an array of thoughts and emotions. It's almost really like creating a novel when you write a memoir, because you're choosing particular events and you're not revealing as much as the reader thinks you're revealing. In other words, that I see memoir as an art form, the way in which it's crafted. And in a sense, memoir is, I think, a form of myth-making in the same way in which I think poems are. And I write about that in my preface to Poetry Will Save Your Life. In other words, that when you begin to recall an experience, you're looking at it back through this lens of being an adult and writing it from a particular perspective. So in a sense, you are creating a myth of an experience, because we can never fully recreate exactly what happened, because reality is always shifting underneath our feet. And I think that has allowed me to write about things that are personal to me, but also I hope are experiences where the reader can come in and find his or her own experience in what I've chosen to write about. For instance, with my memoir, History of a Suicide, I began it as a way to try to understand this tragedy in my family. But as the years progressed, while I was thinking and working and writing on the book, it shifted completely. For instance, it took me about 5 years to realize that this was my story and not my sister's, if that makes sense, that this was my perceptions and my grieving. So it is an art form.
And I was struck by the fact, you know, both of you lost your fathers at approximately the same age.
Yeah, that's
one walking
true.
Out and one
you're
dying.
Right. Didn't consider that. But you're absolutely right. And I always felt that that it was somehow worse to lose a father who's still alive.
Yes.
But I think that I would say to people who are working on memoir also that one has to be brave and one has to stay alert to the truth and not skirt what's there, because I think people turn to these books in order to read about experiences, and there are many different approaches to how to access, through language and trapping time, and it really is an art form, and you have to have a certain amount of craft in terms of narrative and pacing. In other words, sometimes less is more.
True, in many things.
You don't want to overwhelm your reader. And you want to, as I said, sort of create a sense of drama in the way in which you read a novel to keep turning the pages. You don't want it. You want the reader to feel that certain things are being revealed as she or he is reading, because it creates an experience where the reader can be a part of the journey.
It has to be personal truth, not necessarily objective truth.
Right, exactly. And, I always say to people that, you could take one event in a family and five different members of the family may have, very different stories to tell.
Right, the Rashomon effect. Yeah,
right,
absolutely.
Yes, that's right.
We look forward to your appearance here in Tulsa, and I really enjoyed Poetry Will Save Your Life. Jill, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich. It's been a pleasure.
Poet, novelist, essayist, and editor Jill Bielowski speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. Her most recent book is titled Poetry Will Save Your Life, a memoir published by Atria Books. She'll be one of 30 writers and editors that will be a part of Nimrod's Conference for Readers and Writers Saturday at the University of Tulsa. For more information on the conference, visit nimrod.utulsa.edu. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.